All right, this is the final review voluntary session of the environmental law class. And as a result, as opposed to most of our classes, this one is fairly free form. It's really your class. So what I'd like to do today is first of all say, first, it's been a fabulous semester and I really appreciate you guys coming in for this, your last week. I also wanted to just tee it up by going through the sample essay question I put up on the website. Just quick benchmarking. I have hard copies if anyone would like to have any as we're going through it. Okay, just pass around. Just grab it if you'd like. Just make sure I don't accidentally put in the actual exam in here. You laugh. I nearly just did it. Okay. All right. It's also on the website. So what I might do is just sort of talk through it a little bit, give everyone a chance as well to ignore me while I'm talking and read it. And then we can sort of, I can tell you the structure of the final exam, give you as much transparency as I can on how I grade them, so you guys will know what sorts of things you might want to target with your answers. And then we can go through substantively an example to show how that would work with this particular essay question. And then after that, it's open season, whatever you guys want to talk about. I also will talk a little bit about sort of the protocol I've set up just from experience on the week before final exam, so you guys will know how to reach me, what to ask me, the best way to do it, so we can make sure everyone has a chance. So with that in mind, any questions from you before I dive in? All right. Then what I'd like to do is just essentially give you an overview in the final exam, which is essentially what you got in the sample exam is word for word what you're going to get when you come to the final exam next week. I tried to give you literally the exact same cover pages and instructions that you will get, so it will save you the time of having to review them and give you a sense of comfort familiarity when you walk in. I will also tell you that the question I gave you, I'm distressed to see, bless you. I'm distressed to see I've fallen into patterns. I've looked through all my final exam questions I've given so far in this class, and I've discovered that I tend to do the same thing. So hopefully this will give you a sense of comfort as well. I almost always will begin by putting you in a role. I find that the position that you are in will shape the kind of advice that will be requested. And as a result, I will ask you to either analyze or advocate a particular legal question, but from a particular legal viewpoint. So that will be the first thing. Look for where I cast you. After that, I almost always will give you a fairly practical question, usually one that is going to raise a whole host of different issues. I am not the inch wide, mile deep exam guy. I'm more inclined to try and give you something that's more reflected real life, where you have to cast your net broadly, identify the issues, but then also give me some sense of priority as to which ones matter the most and how you would tackle them. After that, I also try not to give you exam questions where you just sit down and type furiously till your fingers bleed. I try to leave it so that you can realistically try and answer it within the space of an hour. As I told you before, the exam is three essay questions, each weighted equally, each I'm expecting you to be able to spend at least about an hour. The other thing I'll tell you, and it happens every year, despite the fact that I have done everything short of falling on my knees and pleading with students not to do this, don't leave blank spaces. I'd like to think I'm a nice guy, and I will try and help you if you give me a good idea in fairly incoherent form. I understand that time ran out, and you were just trying to get it down, and darn it, someone was leaning over you and saying, put down your, I would say pencil, but stop typing. I could be generous if I see good ideas in inchoate form. I can't help you at all if it's a blank piece. Forget it. I mean, I have to give you zero. You've tied my hands. So if you find yourself short on time, I've had students get fairly good grades if they just give me a good, concise, distilled outline of what they would have said if time had permitted. I'm not suggesting you do this with your whole exam. This is the parachute I'm offering you. But if you can do that, it will give you some saving grace. Other things as well, as you all know, this is on a curve. So I will typically do the same thing. I will give a raw numerical score to everybody based on a key where you get a certain amount of credit for certain issues that you spotted, with a more general metric of the essentially the clarity of your analysis and your ability to convey it effectively. And then that number is totally made up. Some years it's 400, some years it's 80. It just depends on the questions I'm asking. But then I'll put everyone in numerical order, and then the person who has the highest numerical score becomes the benchmark A. And then I curve it, and the key thing here is I curve it as hard as I possibly can so I come in mathematically barely under the maximum grade point allowed for the class. So I will try and help out as much as I can in having this curve work out so that you guys are not getting hammered with the fact that you have to be graded on the curve. The only time it's been a problem is when everybody writes incredibly excellent exams. I feel like I've had to get B's and B pluses when they felt like they should have been A's. That's rare. At one time I went back and forth to the administration for four different times, and they told me I was holding up the entire law school's grading package to the Mid-Central campus, and I gave up. But usually, and I hate to say this, please don't take it personally, someone always volunteers to get the C, which makes the A's possible. So try not to be the volunteer for this class if you can. Does that make sense for everybody? Hopefully this is all sort of old hat for you. You've been through enough of these exams that it's ingrained in your DNA. You wake up in a cold sweat at night with your fingers tapping on your finger tap. Okay. All right. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and walk through what I've just described to you with this first exam. And essentially, this is not a hypothetical. This is the exact exam question I gave about 2 or 3 years ago. So this one's actually been live field fire exercise. And you'll notice it's basically what I described. First thing is that I asked you to assume that you are working for the Environmental Law Clinic. There is no such thing, but nonetheless, imagine there's one at the University of Houston. We can go to long stories at some point after this review session as to why we don't have a clinic here. It's an interesting tale. Bottom line is I've asked you to essentially analyze this particular question on behalf of the university. So you are looking to protect the university's interest. You're looking to torpedo, if need be, other people's interest. There is a definite gravity to what, center of gravity to what your answer is going to be. You'll also notice that this question is drawn from recent events. And I assume, I have this dark vision that there's a hidden internet for students only, and that there's a website of instruction manuals for every professor. And for the Professor Hester webpage, it says, likes to draw questions from current events. So that is true. I typically find those the most interesting and thought-provoking. And Eichdike has obviously been in front of the page for a couple of years now. This is an Eichdike question, but it's recast in such a way that the University of Houston is going to be one of the key players to make the Eichdike happen. It also raises a host of different questions, but essentially, and I'll pause here, would it be worth everyone's time for me to walk through the description of the facts, or do you feel like you sort of know what's going on at this point? Wow, no reaction at all. Come on. Get into the analysis. Allie's ready to cut into the last page of the novel. Okay? Well, normally if we were in class, I'd say, what do you guys think? Essentially, I'm not going to do that to you today. I'm essentially going to say, here is your orientation. What is the broadest range of issues that get brought to the play here? I've asked you at the end of this question to focus really on two questions. First of all, what is the potential liabilities that the university might face if it goes ahead with this? And second, what are the permitting needs the university would have to satisfy if they want to participate in this project? One key thing, notice the last sentence. This is common in virtually every essay I give. If I don't give you all the facts, it's not because I was bleary-eyed or sadistic. It's because sometimes, as a practicing lawyer, you will not have the facts. And I will ask you to identify the missing pieces that you might need to answer some of the questions. The important thing is that you know that the question is there. So for here, I'm assuming the first thing you're going to do is pull out a pen and actually start scribbling and underlining and writing on your exam, and then at the back of one of your pages, you're going to outline what you're going to answer before you start typing. You will save yourself hours of pain and agony and second guessing if you just take a couple minutes to pause and rethink and dig down. People don't believe me if this is true. If you write me a 10-page answer that throws everything against the wall and hopes some of it sticks, but write me a 6-page answer that is clear, concise, and gets to the heart of the matter, the 6-page answer wins every time. Volume is not your saving grace. But with that in mind, permitting, think about what we're talking about. Think about what the facts have described here. We're essentially talking about a giant interlocking dike system that is designed to close off the mouth of Galveston Bay and build essentially a giant levee that is going to cut through every possible type of terrain you can imagine. So, what type of permits would that kind of work require? Well, picture the bulldozers plowing through marshy grasslands and birds fleeing in front of them. Obviously, one of the very first things we have to worry about is Clean Water Act permitting. Now, Clean Water Act permitting, by the way, I want to make sure that I'm not giving you too narrow a perspective on this, but essentially, we're talking about two layers of it. Wetlands permitting. Obviously, this is a project that is designed to destroy wetlands. It can't avoid it. There's no way to get around it. So I would expect you'd identify this is going to be one of the key regulatory permitting gaps we need this project done. That might involve you having to have some discussion about what is a water of the United States, where would it apply, where would it be questioned to be applied, and probably you would not escape unscathed unless you mention the word rapidness. I'm not asking you to give me this case recitation. You're not helping yourself by giving me the appellate history or the precise facts of the case. All I care about is that you understand the holding of the case and to the extent there are facts that are germane to applying it to our situation, that you can identify them. I don't need case sites, but the name helps. That I think if you could know the troika of the Waters of the United States cases, that'd be very helpful. And the fact that we have a federal rule currently, final but under litigation challenge, which clarifies some of this. That's not all. A lot of the answers I got said this and stopped. But obviously, it's not just that. To the extent that we're going to be building a dike system and we're going to be involving operation of bridges, of lock systems that are going to have engines and discharges, the description also indicates that it's pretty clear you're going to have wastewater discharges at different points on the system. So we're actually be talking about some form of TIPDES or HIPDES permitting. Again, I don't expect you to give me the permit parameters or out discharge limits. I just want you to give a description to me as to what the permit would involve and who you have to get it from and what sorts of issues that might arise. Notice I also describe in the facts that there are large diesel engines that actually swing the gates open and closed. So just to make sure everyone here is not lapsed into a sugar, psychosis, but more of a coma. What would that in your mind trigger? Sorry? Loudly, so they can hear you in the back row. Although I think Allie was nodding her head, yes, so y'all heard on that, okay? Clean Air Act. All right, if you just say the diesel engines are there, therefore the Clean Air Act applies, that might get you a little bit of credit. What I really would want you to do is to also ask the questions as to what you need to determine to see if the requirements would apply. So for us, basically, I expect you to discuss, you know, whether it's a major source. You don't have to say what the permit limit, what the threshold is going to be for an NSR determination. I don't expect you to tell me tons per year, but I need you to be able to tell me that one question is to determine whether or not the diesel engines are going to be in such a position that they're going to emit enough criteria pollutants to be deemed to be a major source. Presumably, since Houston is non-attainment, it'd be an NSR permit, not a source review, or more non-attainment source review. All clear so far? You know, we could march through the rest of these. I think that they're probably getting pretty familiar to you. There's some discussion about discarding of different kinds of materials during the construction process and operation of the system. So that would raise the question, presumably, what sort of potential hazardous waste issues might be involved. You know, you have to assess whether or not there's going to be hazardous waste generation obligations. And if so, what type of obligations? And here, odds are pretty good that you're going to be advising University of Houston to keep that waste on site for no more than 89 days. Remember the 90-day clock? If you become a treatment storage disposal facility for the Ike Dike, At that point, hope your malpractice carrier is fully paid up. It's a very bad situation. So, you know, you might mention that if that happened, you had to get a TSD, that there's all sorts of bad things that can happen to you. I'll mention a few others here. I'll just put the acronyms and you guys can tell me if they ring a bell. I'll leave the last one because it's the one that a lot of people missed as well. Endangered Species Act. To the extent that this dike system is going to be constructed through areas that might conceivably be critical habitat or potentially endangered species, you're going to have to at least tell your client to ask the question, at least some initial assessment to determine what the range of this endangered species is. If we're going through it, you have to have some type of biological assessment and maybe ultimately a biological opinion. If that gets triggered, we're going to have some type of arguable either Section 7 or Section 9 limits. Section 7, remember, is a federal consultation. So you're going to have to, if there's federal action involved in this dike system construction, they're going to have to get some biological opinion to make sure that they're not jeopardizing the species. And even if there is no federal involvement, there's still Section 9 limits and you can't actually take any of those species. All clear so far? Now, for those of you in the back row who probably are starting to can't see what's getting here towards the bottom, R and HA, Rivers and Harbors Act. I know this one slips under radar a lot, but it's actually pretty important. It's the fail-safe. It almost always gets popped up when you have a situation where someone is discarding something into a river or an outdoor water body. Even if you don't have the Clean Water Act, even if you don't have some of the other statutes that might apply, Rivers and Harbors Act's been knocking around since 1898 for a reason. It applies broadly, applies to almost any kind of navigable water, in fact, and it has a broad criminal sweep. So you have to at least make sure that you pay attention to it. And the last one I've left blank because it's the one that hopefully popped all of your minds anyway. If you're doing this sort of massive project, what's the one thing that you almost always have to have before you can move any dirt? Well, you rephrase that. If you're an environmentalist, what are you going to seize to stop a project in its track if they haven't done it? Spoken like a true former consultant.
EIS.
Okay, so how would you write that in your answer?
I would say that before they can do anything, there's federal involvement to do EIS.
Okay, and if you wrote that one sentence, that's good for partial credit. What else would you say? Remember, you're writing for your client. The client is the University of Houston. They're going to be very smart people who don't really understand maybe some of the background what we're talking about. So you need to basically say, if there's major federal action, that could be either funding or approval, then there must be some type of environmental assessment under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. You don't have to write it out, but I don't know what NEPA means. NEPA then would require, if the environmental assessment does show that there is going to be some type of significant impact, that there must then go forward with a full larger scale, either categorical exception or alternatively an actual full-fledged environmental impact study. So, well, government action can include funding or approval. So the governments have to turn the dirt, but if they're letting you turn the dirt, sometimes that can trigger. There are exceptions to that, and the one that's probably most useful for final exam takers is when EPA approves something that makes it possible. Usually, we don't need an environmental impact statement for EPA approvals. Under what's called the functional equivalence doctrine. Basically, every EPA decision assesses the environmental impact, so it's still going to do an environmental impact study. There are some exceptions. The most important, who issues Section 404 wetlands permits? The Corps of Engineers. No functional equivalence doctrine. It applies to EPA. So usually, this is a federal permit that requires an engineer's approval, which means you have to have an environmental impact statement if this wetlands permit has any kind of significant impact and doesn't have an exception. That's why wetlands permits are usually, let's be honest, they're oftentimes the rinky-dink tail on the project, but they're legally the ones that can halt the big thing. All right? Now, I'm going to pause here. This is a lot of stuff. Write crisply, quickly, plainly, as much detail as you can, but don't make the mistake of failing to get to the second half of the question, which happens all the time. There's a reason why I said there's no eminent domain here. no condemnation authority. There's a reason that I said that they're working in a consortium with others. There's a reason I said that they're going to be plowing through pristine green fields, but also old industrial properties. What does that tell you in your minds? What statute does this? CERCLA, RCRA. This is the litigator's portion of the answer. This is the paradise for causing lawsuits. So essentially, what I'd really be looking for here is CERCLA. And again here, it's not just one sentence, one paragraph. CERCLA covers enough territory that you can actually have serious subparts of it. For example, if you're advising the University of Houston and the University of Houston is having to buy these properties to make the Ike Dyke possible, you need to talk about things like the bona fide purchaser exemption or alternatively the innocent owner purchaser exemptions. Remember those two? Both of which require all appropriate inquiry, due diligence. Bottom line is, when you're writing your answer to the final exam, I really, 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 really hope that you say something along the lines of, tell your client to do a full-scale environmental assessment of the property, phase one, no matter where it's going through, to make sure you've done that inquiry so you can qualify for these statutory exceptions from liability. Let's assume you step in it anyway. The next thing I'd expect you to talk about in your answer is what kind of liability are you talking about? And hopefully this is the sort of thing that I could get you into various intoxicated states and you'd still be able to say it automatically. Liability in CERCLA is joint and several if the harm is indivisible. That's the legal answer. You might even throw in BNSF and Shell if you want to make it a little bit more persuasive. If you want to make it an even better answer, you can say because of that, you can advise your client to define the baseline. Notice how this does the same thing. The inquiry for liability purposes also defines the baseline so that if for some reason additional harm is discovered, you can say that you didn't cause it. It was there beforehand. All right, you basically are creating a reasonable basis to provide the liability. Mm-hmm. All right, is this all hanging together so far? I feel like I'm talking at you really fast. All right. The other one is, who are your co-defendants? Your other PRPs. And here, just I've given you a short potpourri in the question. Just touch base and point out that they're in the suit with you, that they're going to share this liability. It's not like you that's in there. They are as well. And that to a certain extent, you can see contribution from them if you end up having to pay. And then last, notice how the question drops in very quietly and note that they're creating a new entity to carry out this type of participation, which should tell you that there's some issues there with corporate veils and parent liability and how you can hold one corporate entity responsible for the actions of another corporate entity. So I'd expect some discussion or identification of issues right to best foods. Other than that, this is the core of the answer. Other issues that would be great if you had the time, usually the question will signal them for you. So why would I say things like it's going through green fields and old industrial properties and also predominantly minority communities? Environmental justice. Identify that environmental justice is an issue. But at the same time, you might mention that there is no legal standard by which permits can be denied solely on environmental justice grounds or basis for liability. But at the same time, it's an enormously powerful lever on swaying agency action. Also, the question asked for permitting and liabilities, but liabilities can go beyond the statutes. So also, frankly, maybe this is a little bit of an overstatement, but I'll say it anyway. Every question, ask yourself at the end, well, I've given a really fantastic answer. Does tort have anything to say here? The Swiss Army knife, the environmental law? Don't forget that you can also have tort liability here. And it can be in the form of public nuisance, but also any of the other actions we discussed in this class, including just private nuisance, trespass, negligence. even if you navigate all of these, you can still get caught on those. All right? And I think the only other thing that kind of popped up, I'm not really sure. Oh. I put this one with some hesitation. I'm not really sure how much it applies. But suppose you were really phenomenally gifted on the day you took the exam, and it just flew out of you as if it was inspired by the muses. And you found yourself at the 5 minutes at the end of your exam, and you're thinking, what can I put in this last sentence? Well, public trust document. Why? Where is this whole darn thing getting dropped down on? Coastal territory, waters that are held by the sovereign on behalf of the public, fiduciary duties. Keep in mind, the University of Houston, to some extent, is also an instrumentality of the state. So public trust doctrine may actually play an additional role on top of all the others here. But I would not expect you to say much more than that, frankly. If you spent your time doing a deep dive on public trust doctrine and then added all this stuff at the very end in the paragraph, you would not be helping yourself. You need to have some sort of sense as to which issues matter the most and are much directly relevant to the question. But to the extent that you can add issues, the downside of adding an issue that may be of potentially less relevance than the others, what's the downside of putting an extra question, that extra line in there? I'll be honest with you, I do not take off credit for things you put in there unless they're really startlingly, bone-crushingly stupid. And it happens rarely. It has happened, but it's very rare. Generally, I will try and see where you're going, and I sort of give you a little bit of credit for that. But don't chase the little hobgoblins at the expense of the big answers, okay? So, all this, any questions about it so far? Because I'm about to take you behind the curtain. Alan?
One other thing is we have to just make a statement about state, environmental agencies might have been required to permitting.
Oh, always. That's like asking about tort at the end of the question. You know, also ask yourself, make sure that if you just have a federal law to say, state may apply, state may go farther. You don't have to say you commit malpractice if you don't think about the state, but that should be the spirit. All right, good question. Thank you. I should have said that. Any others? All right. What we just outlined here, just so you'll know, the day after your exams, I get them all printed out, and the hard stack gets delivered to me, and I sit in my backyard overlooking my, you know, just sort of enjoying the breeze and the sunlight, and I pull out my answer key. I have answer keys for all the exams. This one's already written, and my desk is pulled together. And generally, it looks a lot like this. It helps me figure out and be fair to everybody with a broad metric to identify all the issues. I also weigh the question answers. So for example, if I think this is the most important, I'll assign an arbitrary number to it, 20. Others might get 10, so this might get 5. And then that gives me the bare bones where I can start giving a number to everybody, but then that's the starting point. I'll adjust the number based on how clear the analysis is, whether you got it right, whether you added things that showed that you went a little beyond the superficial knowledge of it. Basically, at that point, I put it all into a giant spreadsheet and I start curving it till it screams. Does that make sense for everybody? So, three essays exactly like this. And I wish I could tell you more, but I think at some point I could start getting spoiler alerts. Okay? The only other thing I want to talk about with you today, in addition to this, is the middle of the night panic sweats question. You have that question and you realize, oh, I should have asked that, or what is the answer, or I read this in life and I just can't understand it. I am always available for meetings. All I ask is that you contact me and let me know when you want to meet. I'm having to juggle a few other things right now, so I will likely not be just hanging out in my office like I usually do, but I'm glad to be here if anyone needs to talk. The other is I'm always going to be haunting and lurking on my email. Here's the only catch. And I'm not kidding. I would get emails, you know, late past midnight, the day before the final exam. And they would usually be very long and detailed ones from someone who clearly pulled their outline together at the last minute and they were trying to get things pulled together. And it didn't help me to sort of pull it together for them. It didn't help them if I did it. And I found that repeated myself to lots of different students. So what I've done, and hopefully your other professors do something like this, is I ask everyone to send me their email questions. And I promise you I will answer them, but I'm going to answer them all at the same time. So generally, I'm going to ask you to get them all to me by Wednesday before your final exam on Friday. And I will get it all out to you at least a day in advance. So that gives you all a chance to digest it. If you want to ask anything further past that, I'm glad to. But I want to make sure it's an opportunity for all of you to benefit from each other's thinking, frankly. I get great questions. It always pains me that they take place in a one-on-one email rather than in the class. And this is a way to sort of make sure everyone shares it. With the caveat, I'm perfectly fine if you want to keep your question private. But my default is it's public unless you tell me otherwise. And there are lots of reasons you want to keep it private. You may be embarrassed because you think it portrays a certain lack of knowledge. You may feel like you did some incredible, way beyond the curve preparation, and you want to sort of make sure that you're not getting too far ahead of yourself. That's fine. But bottom line is that if you send it to me, it's going to everybody. And not only that, I will usually post it to the website so that if you miss the email, you can still access it anytime you need to. And that's it. Other than that, I'm open for any and all questions, but good luck and Godspeed. No? I thought your hand was up.
So since all the essays are structured like this, if we give our little spiel about each permit or act or whatever we're going into, and if it repeats in another essay,
I try not to do that, but if you do see an opportunity for overlap, there's no point to retyping it. But I'll be honest with you, if you're asking me to go back and pull out your exam on the other question and read it and try and incorporate it in there, I will do so, but it will maybe not be as organic as reading your answer entirely. I have done that before, and usually I try to avoid that because it makes grading them a lot more complicated. If someone messes up on one question, it tends to echo over to the next question as a result. And just each question should be independent if I can make it that way. But if you see it, take advantage of it.
And for acronyms?
As
we go.
I'm of two minds on that. Rest assured, I'll know the acronyms, so you don't need to write them out for me. If you're writing for a client that I've identified for you, I won't insist on it. What I will warn you of is every year at least a couple of students use the acronyms, and because they don't know the underlying term, they screw up the acronym. So it'll be BCAT rather than BACT, or NIPSIN. Anyway, point being, if you put it in the first time and then use acronym the rest of your answer, that's fine. If you just do all acronyms, that's fine. Just if you go all acronyms, just make sure you know what lies underneath so you don't lead yourself astray. All right. Okay. Well, at this point, we can stay as long as you like. Subject to the fact that I have another class starting at 6. We can also end early whenever you like. Just let me know and I can sort of offer up a few final thoughts on the class or anything else you'd like to talk about. But I have to say, I'm just going to ask, do you guys feel like you're ready? Feel like you're comfortable? This class has got you ready to answer this sort of things? My goal is that you could walk out of this class and get plugged into an environmental spot as a summer associate or first year associate, and be able to handle almost anything that's tossed at you, so you at least know where the bodies are buried and you can look it up. So I'm hoping that you all feel that sense of confidence at this point. All right? We're a quiet crew today. Okay. Then with that, I'll just simply say a final thought. I'm not really sure how far I want to go with this. I've had a few of you ask, is this still something worth thinking about in light of what's about to happen? And I know I've talked a little bit about the change in administration, what's coming. And I don't know how much I've shared with you from our meeting in D.C. about a week ago, but I've talked to other people since then and had an actual nice talk with someone who is actually in the running to be the EPA administrator. And I think the bottom line is everyone I've talked to has the same reaction, that environmental law is still just so important, even in the new settings, and that the people who are competent to run the agency are all saying the same thing. They don't want to give up their soul and forego that core mission and in service to the government, which they feel a call to do. I think the bottom line here is that whatever you hear next year, environmental law is going to be one of the busiest areas of practice. It's going to be busy on all fronts. It's going to be an interestingly creative time because we do not have a president who's going to hate environmental law. He's going to be interested in getting at the same environmental results through totally different ways that have been off the table for a long time. So for people who are willing to be creative, willing to sort of set aside some orthodoxies, we might be able to do some things we haven't been able to do for a long time, including passing a lot of environmental legislation. But in the meantime, stay tuned. I love what I do. Everyone I know who practices environmental law, there's no one I know who regrets it. And if you want to talk about that and moving into the field or just have questions in general about it, my door's always open. One last question for you all to go. Who's graduating in the spring? Just you? You're all in the same row here. Okay. In particular, I don't know if you guys are all set where you're going, but if you want to talk about what options are on the table as well, let me know. I'm glad to help out. But congratulations. Premature. And then you have the bar. Okay. Well, then with that, thank you, everyone. Have a great holiday break once you get through the ordeal. And I'll see everyone hopefully next semester. Oh, and where are the cookies? Did y'all take all of them?